Labor and Commerce will come to order at 3:05 on February 6th. With us are Representative Book, Representative Ramirez, Representative Newman, and myself, Chair Olson. We're going to continue on House Bill 320, and I believe we have a committee substitute, and I'll entertain a motion to adopt the CS for purposes of discussion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce CS for House Bill 320 version / E for committee discussion.
And we've been joined by Representative Gardner. I think this is the first time she's been late.
Barely.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, please, Fish. Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide for Representative Meyer, who I believe apologized to the chairman earlier that he couldn't be here before you this afternoon. If the chairman would like, what I'd prefer to do is to walk through the committee substitute, since it does have a couple of substantive departures from the original bill, and then highlight those at the end of my testimony. Beginning in Section 1, what Section 1 does is add a new section to 1860 that would allow the Commissioner of Public Safety to designate or their designee to organize and conduct a search and rescue training mission. Section 2 amends 1860-120 with some clarifying language that you'll see on page 2, lines 3 through 5, that it's only the commissioner or the commissioner's designee or the person appointed to organize, direct, and guide a search and rescue party that can authorize a person to participate in that party. Now, these authorized participants are important when you get down to Section 6. Sections 3, Sections 4, Sections 5 are by and large conforming statutes. Section 5, however, you'll see carries over from the original bill. Section 6, you'll see, this is the meat of the bill where it provides the workers' compensation coverage for a search and rescue volunteer. If you look at line 10, the key being that a person is an authorized participant in a search. So while a search can be conducted, the concern that the Department of Public Safety expressed was that they don't want people showing up during a search where professional volunteers are involved in the search and acting like they're part of that authorized search and getting injured and then being covered. It's really trying to define the scope of who's covered and who is not covered in the event of an accident. Those are basically the sections, Mr. Chairman. The primary departure from the original bill is in the previous committee hearing, there was a lot of discussion about registration and certification and the department registering and certifying, and I believe Representative Gardner expressed several concerns about that, dissuading volunteers from being involved. After working with the department and the search and rescue groups, we've completely removed certification out of this bill and tried to mirror more the way the current system works, which is where the commissioner calls a search, starts a mission, ends a mission. And it's those authorized participants that are covered. So we're getting away from that, really getting into the business of the professional volunteer organizations and just really trying to draw bright lines for the Department of Risk Management and who's covered. That, Mr. Chairman, that's the CS, that's the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, so I just want to make sure we're clear on this, and I support the idea, certainly, but a lot of times there can be somewhat of a, I don't know, maybe a panic type, I don't want to say panic, but I mean there's a lot of commotion and emotion involved in search and rescue missions and people want to help. So is there like a sign-up sheet that maybe somebody who is organizing a search and rescue where you actually have the people's names in there so you know who's a member of the search and rescue mission, since now you don't have to be a member of a professional search and rescue mission, but I understood that you could have a citizen volunteer, if maybe might be the word, but they would go up to a battalion commander or something and volunteer. Is there a list or somebody that so that we know who is a volunteer or on that search and rescue mission? Is there anything like that that requires that?
Representative Newman, through the chair, there is, and that's really up to the troopers. And you'll see in Section 4 of the bill the requirement to promulgate regulations. And you'll see we had to include 115 there, but the troopers are going to have to do more regulations to really drill down and do the command and control of how those lists are handled. As I understand it, most of the time the issue you're describing is very true. However, there could be a case in a very remote situation where the presence of a list or how that works, some of that will still need to be ironed out, but it's specifically related to the commissioner's authority under 120 and 115, who's covered.
Follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mike, I guess why I like to talk about things like that when I'm on a committee, so that we get committee intent, you know, of what we think this means. And I certainly support this, and I know that these people have a tough job, so I just want a little bit for clarification for the department. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Ledoux and Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question's along the same lines. I appreciate the intent of this bill and agree with it. What I want to make sure we don't have is, again, those pesky unintended consequences. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, there's a missing child near water, and the community galvanizes to look for this child, and somebody, one of the volunteer searchers, gets hurt. Is that an authorized searcher now covered or not?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, it would depend entirely on whether or not it was the troopers who had authorized the community to go out and do the search. If the troopers who had designated perhaps a village safety officer or community leader to actually conduct that search, it would really depend on the situation and how the troopers had decided to handle that. So in the instance where a town goes out without going through the troopers to go look for a missing child, no, they wouldn't be covered. If the town went through the troopers and activated the state search and rescue infrastructure, and those volunteers were part of the mission designated by the troopers, then they would be covered up until that mission was ended, if that mm-hmm. answers your question.
Follow up?
Yeah, I mean, you may know exactly and be completely correct. I just wonder if maybe in the interest of limiting or certainly understanding the state's liability under this proposal, that this shouldn't have a judiciary review.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, that's something that I'm sure we can talk with the speaker about. However, the bill does go to finance, and I know that we're talking about the financial liability with risk management in the indeterminate fiscal note is mm-hmm. some concern. So that is something that the fiscal issue and what the state's going on the line for, because the state is a self-insured entity for workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. It's something that the Finance Committee will be very concerned about.
Representative Gardner, we have Brad Thompson with us, the risk manager for the state, that could probably clarify that in a few minutes.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Pulaski? Well, I think at this point in time, I'll bring up Mr. Thompson then to put Representative Gardner at ease. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, Brad Thompson, Director, Division of Risk Management, Department of Administration. We administer, as you point out, the self-insured program that includes the workers' compensation obligations. Those that are proposed in this statute do expand the state's exposure somewhat. I say that somewhat is because our past practice has been to extend in a policy, in an administration search and rescue. We've asked them, and we do this with other state agencies that use volunteers, we ask them to be signed up so that they then, we know when they are in course and scope, and we have had an agreement. It's on our website. We offer it to state agencies to use it for volunteers, such that if there is an injury to a volunteer in state service, we would extend something like workers' comp. You're doing and enacting in statute the obligation to pay workers' comp. But we basically have in a form a commitment to pay any out-of-pocket expenses that volunteer may have. So if they have had a slip and fall while working at the museum, the Pioneer Home, the whatever, and they have out-of-pocket expense for that that is not covered by any other provider that they may have because of employment, because of being a retired, you know, whatever they carry for personal medical, we would extend to them the benefit of paying that because they were serving the state at the moment that injury occurred. And again, that's a contractual commitment in a separate form. We did offer this for the public safety search and rescues that did sign up. So again, we defined course and scope as this. Mike has presented, the department is required to designate when the search would start and stop. And in my hope from risk management that they would then direct and control who is on the list, and if it can't be done at that very moment, they certainly could reconstruct the list for a particular day or a particular search. I believe there is regulation today that requires the person in charge of a search to file a formal report at the end of the search to basically report that activity. And again, we would hope that they would have the listing of those participants in that so that we, in the event of a claim, could present to determine course and scope, provide the benefits as proposed here.
Follow up.
Thank you. So the major distinction between the status quo and the passage of this bill is that somebody who's injured while participating in an authorized search and rescue would get workers' comp benefits instead of the current policy where they get their out-of-pocket costs covered.
Correct, through the chair. That's a succinct statement, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, historically, this has not been a high...
we have had...
High-frequency situation?
We have had, in my recollection, I look back at Mike's request, we had three events involving search and rescue participants, very nominal medical costs only.
And how many years?
In, I think I look back 10 years.
Any further questions for Mr. Thompson? We've got Lieutenant Dial online for questions. We have Chuck Springer, who testified last week. Chuck, do you have anything new, or Chuck Springer?
Yes.
Do you have anything new, or from your testimony last week?
No, I do not.
And we also have Paula Sankey in the room. Questions only. Division of Workers' Compensation. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on the bill, or anybody online? With that, I'll bring it back to the committee and Ms. Gardner, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Sorry, another question for the sponsor, if I might. I guess if we've had three claims under the status quo, call it claims, in 10 years, is the purpose of this bill then preemptive or to cover currently, to cover the professionals who are often called in to volunteer, firefighters and police officers and such?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, again for the record, this is Mike Pulowski, aide for Representative Meyer. The point of the bill is entirely preemptive. The concern being that one major accident where volunteers are out in the field trying to save somebody, where if you consider the philosophy underlying the workers' compensation system, it's that an employer and an employee agree not to sue each other. If you look at the statutes in the bill, and I believe it's Section 3, you'll see that search and rescue volunteers are prohibited from suing the state. And so the concern being is that these are dangerous situations. You're out there looking for an avalanche. If volunteers get hurt, and they have no recourse, and we're covering only a little bit. Mm-hmm. These are people that are fulfilling a very important role for the state, and we'd hate to see them left out there in the event of an accident. That's really the goal of the sponsor, and that's the intent of the community that's been asking for this.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I guess I'm more of a committee. The discussion here, I don't have a question for Mr. Pulaski. I kind of thought we were at that point, but you know, I say thank you to Representative Meyer for recognizing this and carrying it. First off, Secondly, I think that this committee is more than competent enough to deal with it in this committee without further committee referrals. And I also think that as a catch, even if we do screw up here in the legislature, which we do sometimes, again, as was pointed out, in the definitions of the regulations, the public safety gets to adopt the regulations that are necessary, and then they have the Administrative Procurement Act, Procedure Act. There's several places in here, I think, where the administration, the people who deal with this every day, who probably came to you and asked for this, you know, I trust them to do their job. So, comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It has one further committee. It's going to finance after we move it out of this committee. We're assuming that we move it out. And with that, I will bring it back to the committee. Representative Gardner?
If we're ready, I'm ready to propose moving it out.
I'll entertain a motion to that effect.
Okay. Well, then, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill 320. That's version E with attached fiscal note and any individual recommendations.
Seeing no opposition, this bill will move on to finance. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Bill 316. Emily, are you prepared to present it to the committee? And could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Sure. My name is Emily Stancliffe, aide to Representative Ramirez.
I'll entertain a motion to adopt the CS for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, could we start over, please?
Yes, can we? Yep. For the record, my name is Emily Beatley. My husband will murder me, but I just use my maiden name. My new last name is Beatley. And for the record,
could we back up the tape, please?
That's Beatley, staff to Representative Ramirez.
I'll entertain a motion to adopt the CS for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move CS for House Bill 316 /M for committee discussion.
Please continue.
Okay.
You want to join her, or you want to do it from here?
Well, for the record, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to know how long you've been married.
7 months.
All right. I'll let her
through the chair. 7 months.
He's quite competent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing the bill. What I'd like to do is just provide a little bit of a background on prescription data monitoring programs, acronyms PDMP or PMP, just so you have an understanding. I know there's been a lot of information provided in your packets, and I'm not sure how much you've been able to sort through, but all states have laws and regulations that govern the distribution and handling of controlled substances and other pharmaceuticals. Diversion of controlled substances and other pharmaceuticals is generally recognized as a serious problem throughout the United States. As of December 2007, 35 states had enacted legislation which required prescription monitoring programs, and 14 additional states are in the process of proposing, preparing, or considering legislation. Goals for prescription monitoring programs vary from state to state, and they depend on the missions of the agencies that operate the program and utilize the data. Although the goals are different, there are major objectives that generally apply, and those are education and information, public health initiatives, early intervention and prevention, investigations and enforcement, and protection of confidentiality. States have found that prescription monitoring programs are among the most effective tools to identify and prevent drug diversion at the prescriber, pharmacy, and patient levels. Prescription monitoring programs aim to be supportive and the least disruptive to medical and pharmacy practice. Reporting time in some states takes only 3 to 5 minutes to submit the data. It is important to note that prescription drug data will continue to be available only to entities that already have access and the right to obtain data under state law. The database is just a tool that will assist in prescribing and dispensing practices to improve the health care for all Alaska citizens. The systems are not used as a target for possible subjects of an investigation, but rather to assist once an official complaint has been received. The information in the system, however, is examined more closely when blatant abuses are revealed in the data. The need for this legislation, there's a few reasons. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development currently conducts research and licensee investigations regarding drug diversion practices. State and local law enforcement agencies are experiencing a rise in prescription drug diversion criminal activity. DCCED, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, has already received the first level of funding for research into a prescription monitoring program, and the next level of federal funding is available for implementation of a program, and that's about $400,000 once legislation is in place. I have a few statistics of drug diversion just to bring you aware, make you aware of the problems faced throughout the United States and here in Alaska. In a national survey on drug use and mental health, it was found in 2006 that there were 7 million persons aged 12 or older who used prescription type psychotherapeutic drugs non-medically in the month previous to the when the survey was taken. Of those, 5.2 million used pain relievers, an increase from 4.7 million in 2005. And among persons aged 12 or older who used pain relievers non-medically in the past 12 months, 55.7% reported that the source of the drug they used most recently was from a friend for free. Another 19.1% reported that they got the drug from just one doctor. And according to the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, Alaska has one of the highest per capita uses of controlled substances. And at this time, we've heard that there is, well, we know that there is a misconception that misuse of prescription drugs is safer than using illicit street drugs. And I've heard examples of kids using prescription drugs from their parents' medicine cabinets, taking them to parties, throwing them in a bowl, and everyone just taking a handful. And so this is just one example of the misconception that they're safe to use to take to parties. What this bill does for those who haven't had a chance to look it over is that it establishes a prescription monitoring program within the Board of Pharmacy, and the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development will assist the board with the necessary staff and equipment to implement the program. And the database will contain data for every prescription that is dispensed for a Schedule 1 through 5 under state and federal law. The procedure and the format for submitting the data will be established by the Board of Pharmacy. And the data to be submitted is identified generally in the bill, and there's a list, but would be defined more specifically by the Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy will maintain the data to facilitate the use of identification of scenarios such as prescribing and dispensing practices, unprofessional and unlawful practices, individuals who receive prescriptions inappropriately, and all of the database, all the information contained within the database is confidential and not subject to public disclosure. The board is required to ensure the security and confidentiality of the database, and specific data security requirements will be at the discretion of the Board of Pharmacy through regulation. Some of the uses for the data are that it can be used by the Board of Pharmacy regarding license inquiries. And like I stated earlier, that's not to target any one person. It's when actual claims have been brought to the board. Data can be used by the board personnel or contractors for operational and review purposes. The data can be requested through the board by an individual who's the recipient of a controlled substance. And in the bill, you'll find that we've set a maximum fee for requesting information about yourself at $10. We thought anything higher than that to process a request would be just too much. Also, the data can be used by licensed practitioners who have the authority to prescribe when they're considering a specific and current patient. This isn't for patients that they know of with other doctors. This is for when they're prescribing a drug for a specific patient within their office. The data can be used by a licensed or registered pharmacist who is considering dispensing a controlled substance to a current patient. And also, the data can be used by federal, state, or law enforcement by request through the board with a search warrant, subpoena, or court order issued with a warrant, subpoena, or court order that has been issued by a court establishing probable cause for access and use of the information. There's also set forth in the bill that failure to submit the data as required is grounds for the board to take disciplinary action. The bill in the CS version now allows for agreements between tribal and military dispensers. Right now, the tribal and military are, they fall under federal requirements, which supersedes the state law. So they're not required, but this allows for agreements. And I know other states have entered into agreements with some of the tribal and military units. The board requires that the bill requires that the board notify the legislature if federal funding for the program runs out. It's not the intent of the sponsor of this bill to have professionals who access the database to carry the burden of the cost. And that's been one of the concerns that we've heard during the companion bill hearings over on the Senate side. This program should be funded through federal grants and state appropriations. And an individual who has submitted to the database in accordance with statute may not be held civilly liable. Nothing in this section requires or obligates a dispenser or a practitioner to access or check the database before prescribing or dispensing a medication. So this is a tool for dispensers and prescribers to use, but they cannot be held civilly liable for failing to do so before prescribing to a patient. Data misuse in the bill is classified as a Class A misdemeanor. This is intentional disclosure without the authority or allowing someone with unauthorized access to use the data. And like I said, that's a Class A misdemeanor. And there's also a Class C felony for intentional access to alter or destroy data without authority. So that's summary of the CS version in front of you. We took into account a lot of testimony, like I said, that was heard during the committee for the companion bill on the Senate side, and we've tried to incorporate all of that into the CS.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did an excellent job of presenting. Thank you. And the other, for the members of the committee, the other genesis for this bill is I attended the, I don't want to say it correctly, the LUSAC Library, the methamphetamine conference, I guess, and it was attended the pre-meeting by the 10 people that this body helped create a board to fight methamphetamine across our state. We were joined by a member of the DEA from the White House who expressed a national interest in creating this prescription bill monitoring database, and that unlike when it was offered some years ago by Representative Chenault, we didn't have the computer capacity at the time, nor did we have available funding. It was too cumbersome and expensive. So our office, in conjunction with the Senate President's office, are working this through both both parts of the building and hope to meet up somewhere in the middle. We think it's an important step in trying to control what kind of things people are ingesting and then going to work and going on our road system and the damage that they're doing to themselves by getting hooked on drugs. And if you see the fiscal note, we think that you know, this is commonly known as doctor shopping, but the nature of reselling pharmaceuticals is called diversion. And if we're able to curb the diversion of Medicaid-funded inappropriate purchase of pharmaceuticals, this program actually has a negative fiscal note over time. And so we think it's responsible, it's good for society, and we think it's a very has some very redeeming qualities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have four questions about different areas to kind of start off. I find this bill sort of intriguing, and I'm, you know, I guess my questions will lead me to making a decision, but the questions are, and I can give them all to you, and because they might flow into each other. One is about HIPAA, and I don't know if the committee substitute has addressed HIPAA concerns adequately, or if there have been HIPAA problems in other states that have it, have this bill. Second is about liability for data loss. I'm always worried when we have any agency collecting data, and I know you said that the board would be responsible for maintaining security, but what liability would the state have in the event that the data is stolen or accessed inappropriately? And then where this has been in place in other states, I'm curious to know how often it's accessed by the people for whom it's intended, dispensers and prescribers, is that those words you used? And then lastly, I understand that there's federal grants available to get it started. Do we have any inkling about whether those grants will be ongoing or when they might just sort of end? And I think that's it for now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gardner, through the chair. As far as the HIPAA requirements, there's actually an exemption in HIPAA that prescription monitoring programs fall under. In it, it says it's there's an exemption if the program and the provision of state law is necessary to prevent fraud and abuse related to the provision of health care. And its principal purpose is the regulation of the distribution, dispensing, or other control of any controlled substance. So they actually fall under that exemption. Okay. And as far as liability for stolen data, I'm not sure of the liability. Ginger's nodding her head. Ginger is actually carrying the bill on the Senate side and may have more answers on that as to the liability. If not, maybe someone online can testify. We have Brian Howes, the senior investigator with DCCED, okay, who may have better understanding as to the board's regulations and the privacy and the confidentiality. And how often it's accessed. I know that some states are going to require that it's mandatory because they are finding it such a useful tool. They would like doctors to mandatorily check because they are finding that they're accessing the data and that it's been such a helpful tool. And but I can get you numbers if you want about how often it's accessed. All I know is that in all the states that I've talked to, and when Brian and I have been in conversations, he's actually traveled down to the lower 48 and witnessed the prescription drug programs firsthand, and that they've all seen success stories from using it and have found them invaluable. So, but I can't speak to numbers on how often it's accessed. Okay. And funding-wise, the federal funding is the first stage is for the research. The second stage is for implementation. That's the $400,000. And then following that, there's enhancement grants. And I've talked to some that say that their states have continuously gotten enhancement grants after the first receipt of those federal funds. But as far as to a certainty of federal funds, I don't think anyone has an answer to that question. And that's that would be up to state appropriations or other funding tools. And I think I stated in testimony, but it's not our intent to have the cost fall on the licensed members and the professionals that will be using it. And so we would hope that the cost saved through Medicaid and through insurance would help to cover those in the future when the federal funds run out. So
thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't need exact numbers in other states, but I am curious to know where it's voluntary as we propose here. And I'm just thinking a busy pharmaceutical dispenser, you know, taking the time to actually make the call or go online or however to actually do it. I wonder if they really do or if they just fill it and move on.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I can't speak to that, but I would hope that Brian Howes, he's online, and like I said, he's gone and actually spoken and gone to conferences and has a much better understanding as to how often these are accessed in other states. And I know that Ginger said she'd be available for questions, so maybe if she could offer any more to that, we can have her do so.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Newman, followed by Representative Liddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have several questions, Mr. Chair, so let me get through this. First, let me say, in all due respect to Senator Green and Representative Ramirez, it's probably not a lot more I despise than government keeping records of people. I just have a real problem in my heart with that one. I can't get there. And I think we kind of, on page 4, talked about the database of information, and the board shall undertake to ensure the security of that. Or what? My question is, or what? What if there is a breach of security? What if a member of the board breaches that security? What if, you know, well, we'll just go with that one and go to the next question.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Through the chair, in the, let's see if I can find the page number for you in the back of the bill. As I stated the summary of the bill, there are Class A misdemeanors for someone who intentionally discloses information without authority, or if someone allows an unauthorized person in their office, say a prescriber has an access code and they allow someone who's not authorized to go in and access the data, that's a Class A misdemeanor. And anyone who goes into the database and breaches security with their authorized access to destroy or alter information, that's a Class C felony. So,
what is a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony?
I couldn't speak specifically, but Representative Ramirez.
We were just recovering that on a bill for Representative Stoltz about intentionally burning vehicles, and I had the same question. Class A misdemeanor is punishable by up to $5,000 in penalties and 1 year in prison. Class C felony is punishable by up to $10,000 fine and 5 years in prison.
If I may
follow up.
So it's up to, so there's no mandatory. And I just wonder, you know, I know how busy, I'm beginning to get an understanding how busy the DA's offices are and when it comes to prosecuting things like this and where they fall on their priority list. And I probably not high on their priority list, but I know that there's a lot of people out there on the internet and across this world that would love to hack in. There's pretty smart people that hack into a lot of databases that the government already has.
Right.
So I'm very, very, I got some problems with there, but we'll go on to the next one. A court can receive this information. So if there's information on somebody about the prescription medication that they're receiving, and we have a petition from the court to receive this information out of this database. I guess that's what you call it, I'm guessing. I don't watch court TV that much. But is there some confidentiality? Is this kept under seal with the members of that are involved here, or is this become public information in a court system?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I believe it would be confidential information to the law enforcement agencies that are investigating with the board. And you're right, it is a warrant, subpoena, or court order that's been issued after probable cause. We do have Department of Public Safety Captain Mallard on the line to testify as to maybe some of the issues that they've currently had and whether or not he sees this as a valuable tool for the Department of Public Safety, who would be the ones that would be requesting the access for investigations. And he might be able to further clarify that for you.
If I may continue. So it is sponsor's intent that this be kept under seal, so that it's not open to anybody in the public except under the strictest regulations controlled by a judge in control of that court?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, are you asking for the data itself or the database? Because it is our intent to have the database be kept under the strictest confidentiality and only, and the bill actually says only to the following persons, and we've listed five or six here. And so outside the scope of those six people, we would not be granting access to the database. So we are limiting in the bill to only the six that are listed, and law enforcement being the ones that can access it with a court order. And theirs is simply written. They can't actually log into the database and have direct access. They can only request it through the board. So theirs is more limited in scope than some of those that are listed above it.
And if I may continue, I don't want to drag on here, but this is very important to me. And so it's sponsor's intent.
Yes, sir.
That this be kept under seal.
Yes, sir. And I can tell you, through the chair, Representative Newman, I can tell you that in the research that I've done, in the 10 to 15 years that these have been working, there has never been a case of a breach of data or secured data ever being hacked into, or to use some other computer words, to date. And there has not been a case of that. So they are all contracted with vendors who maintain the strictest confidentiality and have firewalls and other things in place to protect the data. And so it was certainly our hope that the board would contract with those vendors and in doing so protect those that they're licensed to cover.
And
so
thank you. And I understand a little bit of the consequences of this, because my wife still has the same glow around her that you've got after 7 months after 24 and a half years. But she's a pharmacy tech. And so I hear a little bit about the things, you know, that can happen.
Right.
And I understand that, but some of the other concerns that I may have is on page 3, in paragraph 3, where it talks about a drug outlet quantities and frequency inconsistent with generally recognized standards of dosage for a controlled substance. Now, doctors, it's ultimately up to a doctor prescribing a medication to a patient. And sometimes those don't fall within generally prescribed methods that are sometimes used as a generally prescribed, because there's cancer treatments that fall outside of that. among one of the probably most prevalent in that, where you have doctors, and I know that I had an eye injury, and the treatment that they had used for my eye, it wasn't something normally treated for eyes, but they needed it because of the molecular makeup of it that the doctor felt it would be better for it, which wouldn't have been genuinely recognized. Now, I happen to know that because it happened to me once, and this would have fell outside that, so now his, you know, Dr. Odlin, who's probably one of the most recognized, respected doctors in the Valley, I think, you know, and that would have jumped out here, and that concerns me, you know, because that's, I trust my doctor, and I believe that when a doctor writes a prescription, that the pharmacist, when they fill that prescription, they look already now and to make sure that it falls under generally recognizable practices for the use of that medication. And if not, they call the doctor and say, is this really what you wanted? And then they go to the person who's receiving it and they say, now this is, here's the whole story on this. Is that generally how that works?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, that's my understanding that the pharmacists are required to check with the doctors if they see a dosage level or a prescription that may not fall within the norm. And I can say that that is exactly what you're talking about is the reason that we've chosen to house this prescription program in the Board of Pharmacy, because we do feel that they're best suited to establish prescribing practices and the norms. And as I was stating earlier, you know, it's certainly not the intent to target anyone with this. It wouldn't be the intent to target the doctor that maybe prescribed a certain regimen that was outside of what you would normally see, but it would be a consistent misuse of prescribing practices or overprescribing that would throw these flags to whatever prescribing practices the board had set forth. So it would have to be a continual
not once in a while, but
right. Yeah, they would have to see a pattern that was established in the data, and so I can't say whether or not the doctor did would be one, but I certainly would believe that it is a pattern, and it isn't just a one incidence type of thing.
I appreciate the clarification. Yeah. That if there's an established pattern, then the board can look at that. A couple more questions, if I may. Well, just while I'm looking at this, is where you have in the CS where it says subsection B4, the first line, it says remove language requiring information from the person picking up medication. What language was removed? When? Why was it removed? And what does it say now?
Representative Newman, through the chair, in the previous version of the bill, on page 3, line 12 of version C, it states that the name and address of the person for whom the prescription was written and the name and address of the person who picked up the prescription. And it was during testimony on the Senate side that the Nurses Association raised concerns for healthcare workers who pick up prescriptions for those that are in home facility or licensed inpatient facilities. They have to go and pick up the information. I know one is a nurse for Covenant House in Anchorage, and she frequently goes and picks up prescriptions, and they were concerned about having their own information being logged as the person picking up the prescription, and were concerned about that. There was also a concern that it's not actually information that's already being reported by pharmacies. So the Alaska Pharmacists Association said that it would be actually burdensome to start including this piece of information because it's not something that they already track. They do track the name and the address of the person for the prescription, so it was removed to address those two concerns during the committee discussion, and we felt it was something worthy of addressing in our CS version.
Just to clarify then, the only information that is kept in a database is the prescription and who it's prescribed to, and its medical reason, or just who it was prescribed to, their name, address, not social security number, but just name, address, and a prescription?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, yes, the date of the prescription would be included, and the date the prescription was filled, as well as the method of payment, and the name and address for only the person who it was prescribed for, not for anyone who picks it up. For instance, if your wife picked up your prescription for you, her name and address would not be included in what was submitted. The name and the national code for the controlled substance, the quantity and strength, which may be one of the one of the things you were addressing, and the name and the drug outlet that's dispensing the substance, as well as the name of the pharmacist or practitioner that's dispensing the controlled substance. We do have other relevant information is required by the board in the bill to address other information that may become useful in the future that they would be able to set forth in regulations.
Okay, and just want to make sure we're straight on that one. And then sure. Just lastly, it says in section 2, I guess subsection 7, remove language requiring information regarding dosage, quantity, and frequency. What did it say before, and what does it say now, and why were those changes included?
Those were changed in the through the chair, Representative Newman. Those were changed in the previous bill because they actually, it was a duplication of line 6. It was felt that the language, they were the same, and so they just removed one because it was redundant in the bill, so it was just a cleanup.
So I understand that.
So in the CS version, the quantity and strength of the controlled prescribed substance covers what was removed in 7 of the original bill.
So still in the database, the information regarding dosage, quantity, and frequency is still kept in the database?
That is, through the chair, that is correct, Representative Newman.
Why does it say remove language requiring information on the CS? I mean, just in changes in the CS, I just want to mention that.
Representative Newman, through the chair, and that was a mistake on my part. I didn't add that it was removed in the original version, so it was removed in the original version, and that's where the change takes place in the CS. So that was my error. I apologize for that.
That's for now. I'll let somebody else talk a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Gardner.
Yeah. I want to just make sure that I understand this bill. So if I go to a pharmacist and I want to get a prescription refill, does all the pharmacist have to do is plug my name, Gabrielle Ledoux, into this database, and just like Google everything about my medical history or everything about every prescription I've ever had in the world is going to come up before him?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, it is my understanding that there's different prescription databases that are out there, each of them providing information in a different way. The board is currently researching, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development is currently researching which type of prescription monitoring database they would have. One of those is a web access where you would have access through a login code that was confidential and private to you, and then through that code would have access to your name. They could look up your name and your history of prescribed medications, doctors who have prescribed medication to you. And I think just to reiterate what I stated in the opening is that this information is already available. Doctors already are keeping your information. What this does is just place it in one location, and so that doctors aren't having to contact different offices to get history on your prescribing practices, or pharmacists, excuse me. And so all the information would be stored in the one location. And so to Google your name, as to put it, would be, they would be able to access your specific information with their login. They would be able to specifically look up what has been prescribed to you.
I mean, and that's what you want. That's what this bill wants, is that somebody can basically Google anybody in this room. Like a pharmacist gets kind of bored and nothing's going on, so he can just plug in somebody's name and...
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. No. The bill specifically states that a prescriber who is prescribing information can only look up information for a current patient who he is prescribing information to at the time. He cannot... fish for information is a word that some have used to find information about anyone he would choose and Google in your sense. It is not acceptable to do that, and and it's not the intent of the sponsor to allow someone to do that. The bill actually states that it is for only a current patient and that they're prescribing for, as well as prescribers.
So what, I mean, maybe that's not the intent of the bill, but what in the bill prevents the board pharmacist from doing this?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, in the back of the bill where it talks about the misdemeanors, somebody who intentionally discloses information without authority or allows someone to access the database isn't a misdemeanor. We have drafted some language through legislative legal to address phishing information. It was something that we were considering taking up in the next committee of referral, the Judiciary Committee, if that was something that continued to be a concern. I believe our legal drafters was confident that the Class A misdemeanor without a person who intentionally discloses information without authority would cover the phishing of information, but if we needed to be more specific, we certainly have an amendment drafted that we would consider.
But that's only if the person discloses information without authority. Suppose he's just sort of curious and he looks at it himself. Doesn't disclose it to anybody else. How are you going to deal with that?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair.
Ginger can assist you with that.
Ginger, please join.
If we could have Ginger Blaisdell, who has actually has had many discussions with legal on the phishing of information issue that you're raising. She seems to have some answers for you to your question.
For the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm staff to Senator Green. We've had similar questions on what you've brought up. And let me clarify one small point. When you go to your pharmacist and you want to get, say, a refill, typically what they ask for is your RX number, and it's a number on your bottle. They look that up, and that's the only piece of information that comes up on a database. It's not going to give your entire drug history, ailment description, anything like that. It just says, can I refill it or can't I? So they aren't going to know maybe why you're receiving an antibiotic and need a refill. You know, they aren't going to see additional information. The way this database interacts is, say at the end of the night or end of the week, whenever the Board of Pharmacy says they need to download data, this database is told to go out, capture certain fields, send it to a data warehouse where it's stored securely, and then the state or pharmacists or prescribers can access it. You actually won't see most of the drugs that people are prescribed. You will only see those federally controlled substances. So you're only going to see past history on painkillers, stimulants, tranquilizers, those types of things. You won't see if you're taking high blood pressure medication or any other medication.
Now, where does that say that in the bill?
I think the part of the bill that would be most helpful for this is, well, let me address it a little bit differently. On the section on page 3, where it talks about the items that are being collected in this database, on line 14, item number 5, is the name and NDC, or National Drug Code, for the controlled substance. That's the only piece of information that's collected. So there's no ailment listed, there's nothing else. It's only controlled substance, and it's not any of the other medications you may be picking up.
Is the definition of a controlled substance, I always assumed that anything was controlled as long as you couldn't get it unless you have a prescription. So that wouldn't, a controlled substance doesn't include all prescription medication then?
Actually, in section, let me see which one it is. I guess the entire section 2 discusses this. We're specifically identifying Schedule 1 through 5. And state schedules and federal schedules differ slightly. but Schedule 1 is typically your illicit drugs or illegal drugs. In the state of Alaska, it includes Oxycontin and codeine, which is why we include Schedule 1 in our statute here. Schedule 2 are typically your pain relievers, fairly strong narcotics. Schedule 3 are typically your psychotropic type drugs, so like maybe Ritalin, different kinds of stimulants. When you get down to Schedule 5, those are your real low-dose narcotics, maybe a cough syrup that contains codeine. And so that's why Schedule 1 through 5 are specifically listed as being the only controlled substances tracked by this database.
Okay. A couple more questions?
Or new question.
Okay. I think you said that, you know, it's not your intention, you know, that the pharmacists ever end up actually paying for this because there's the federal funds and so forth. Federal funds seem to have a habit of going away, and they seem to be going away more and more. What's the intentions, you know, if the federal funds should go away?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair. Thank you for the question. And actually, that was the reasoning behind adding Section G on page 5, that the board should notify the legislature if at any time the federal funding fails to pay the cost. And on the Senate side, with the president of the Senate, they have actually authored an intent letter stating the intent to follow the bill, and we have also drafted a similar letter stating that it is not the intent of the sponsor or the bill to have the cost fall on the professional users of the database. And certainly we could give the letter to Representative Olson. We also expected to probably hear about it again in finance, because we know this bill will eventually have a finance referral due to the fiscal notes. And so if you prefer us to address it here, we can certainly add that letter to the bill so that it can follow through the committees with the intent language in the letter.
So what would be the fiscal note on the bill if the federal funds dried up?
Representative Olson Representative Ledoux through the chair. I believe Ms. Strickler with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development is here. She could speak to the fiscal note, having drafted it, and she could maybe give more information as to whether or not it would change due to the intent of the sponsor.
So thank you.
Hopefully she could do that.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I would like to kind of respond to some of the questions that Representative Newman had about whether the information obtained in a criminal investigation would be available to members of the public when it's used in a court hearing. And I could be wrong about this, but in a previous life, I used to work as an advocate for children in state custody, and many of the families had problems with drugs. And I often would go down and look up their criminal records, and I could pull the file and look at things that had been used in the hearings and stuff. So unless I'm mistaken, I think that evidence entered into the record is part of the public record, with some exceptions, rape victims, some children's cases, things like that. But for the adults, if the information is obtained by law enforcement and turned into court, I think it is available to anybody who wants to look. It's part of the evidence. I maybe could be corrected here by Representative Ledoux.
I mean, it would be part of the evidence, wouldn't it, if anybody is actually through the chair. If anybody is actually being accused and tried for something. But I mean, if it's not anybody's business normally, if there's no crime that anybody's been accused of.
Thank you. Through the chair?
Sure.
That's a great segue into what I also wanted to say is my understanding of this bill, and there's a lot of concern about innocent people and people who don't have a drug problem or whatever, is it has two functions. One is a lot of drug addicts do doctor shopping.
and a doctor who has a patient in front of him, somebody he doesn't really, or he or she doesn't really know, who says, I have a pain, I need morphine, I need this, I need that, they might suspect that this is a person who's doctor shopping, but they have no way to really evaluate it. And this is a tool to let them just say, clear their own conscience. I'm not giving drugs to a drug addict who's conning me, because they can be very, very good. And I understand the value of that. The other thing is, we hate to think it, but there are corrupt doctors who sell prescriptions. And so this is another tool for the Board of Pharmacy, and I'm guessing that that's one of the reasons they might support it, because it lets them police their own. And that's very important, because there's a lot of temptation. So, thank you.
Representative Ramirez.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, you sound like a co-sponsor.
I started, through the chair, I started out disliking it on civil liberties issues, but I'm kind of coming around.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ginger, am I to understand then that only the board who is appointed to look at this and to create this and have oversight has access to medical records of the prescription drugs that are purchased by somebody walking into a pharmacy purchasing drugs?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. Actually, the Board of Pharmacy, I guess the first step, the Board of Pharmacy, is that they will have to adopt a lot of regulations that more clearly define how this program would actually work. And they would probably adopt regulations that would truly define how reports are provided, how they're available to people, what information is going to show on them. Do they have direct access to it? Yes, possibly. It depends how they regulate themselves. There are some examples from some states where the Board of Pharmacy does not access their own database. Their investigator has access to it, and the computer people have access to it in order to review the data to make sure that it's actually the correct item is falling into the correct field in the database itself. Some boards have governed themselves so that they do not see any data unless specific, they call them flags, show up. So an automated report might be generated from the computer system that says, we have a single individual who has accessed 30 or more doctors and 20 or more pharmacists in the last 12 months. That might be a circumstance for a red flag that says, this person may need to be reviewed. At that point, they might assign their investigator to start calling the doctors and pharmacists saying, you know, are you treating this person for an unusual ailment? Do they have an unusual pattern? But it's looking for a long-term pattern, not a single event. So it depends on how the Board of Pharmacy wants to allow itself access to the database and just what restrictions they want to put on themselves.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair.
Actually, what I'd like to do with the indulgence of the committee is we've got several people online that can probably bring a different perspective to this and answer most of the questions that we still have out. If that's not a problem, I think we'll... pardon me? I think...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll bring some clarification to it. Deborah Kiley, are you with us? Deborah Kiley? Gone. Brian Howes.
I'm here.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record, Brian?
My name is Brian Howes, and I'm the senior investigator for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. We're under Commerce.
Do you have a prepared statement, or are you willing to take questions, or do you want to start shooting at some of the questions that are still open?
I have both, and some of my statement might answer a lot of the questions, I'm hoping. And I can do that, start with that?
That's fine.
Okay. My name is Brian Howes, and I'm the senior investigator for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. I, along with the chief investigator, Richard Yonkin, supervise investigators and staff that provide inspection, enforcement, and investigative services to the boards in 35 different occupations licensed by the division. So providing these services, the Board of Pharmacy is permitted to release confidential information to this division, and in lieu, and going doing so does to the other boards, specifically the healthcare boards. I'm not going to reiterate all the things that, you know, Emily and Ginger have talked about. They've done a very good job. But I want to talk a little bit about how the bill benefits our division and how we operate. A little bit has to do with through the current state and federal and HIPAA exemptions, the data gathered by the program is already available to us. It doesn't change any of that access, or it doesn't provide, change any access to the prescribers or the dispensers or to law enforcement. It doesn't change any of that. Prescription abuse is a problem in Alaska, as we've talked about, and the goal is to reduce prescription abuse by identifying the illegal use, such as forgery, blanket prescribing, and doctor shopping. It does provide for the data to be readily accessible to these entities and individuals, and also provide a searchable record for who accessed that data. And for an investigator standpoint, the prescription monitoring bill will provide a program for the investigators to have a timely access to prescription information and the following information, making collection of the information easier and less intrusive, reducing the time and effort needed to explore leads to assess possible drug diversion or overprescribing cases, allowing investigators to obtain pharmacy data from multiple locations without having to visit or mail a letter to every pharmacy, provides access to the data electronically versus sorting through paper copies of the prescription. Our current process is that upon receiving an allegation of prescription abuse, diversion, or overprescribing, the division will send out requests to the pharmacies within the state for prescription information regarding either the prescriber or the patient involved. We don't send out an all-inclusive list since there's about 400 different pharmacies licensed in the state. Usually there's about 40 that are predominant that we will send a request to. A lot of it's dependent on the location of the complaint, say the Fairbanks, Juneau, Anchorage, that type of thing. But that doesn't necessarily help us because a person that is doctor shopping, or if you have an unethical prescriber, they're going to recommend that they go to various pharmacies to spread it out. What I'm saying is that we're not receiving all the data that is available to us because in reality there's no current and cost-efficient way to readily access the information. As a case example, we received a doctor complaint regarding the overprescribing and drug diversion for multiple patients. We sent out requests to roughly 40 pharmacies, and the response was over 10,000 prescriptions. These prescriptions came in a paper form with approximately 25 to 30 prescriptions per page. This information was then transferred into a database to separate out the patient, the date of the prescription was filled, the drug prescribed, the drug quantity, other prescribers, and the location of the pharmacy. The data entry for this case took well over 3 months and involved multiple personnel. This is similar to being tasked to do 2 years' worth of bank reconciliation for 30 to 40 people, and the formats being completely different. The database will allow this process to be resolved within a matter of minutes versus months, the significant time and cost savings. The process is less intrusive to the pharmacist and the healthcare provider while still allowing the division to fulfill its mission by evaluating the complaint and all supporting material to include prescribing data, which either sustains or refutes the complaints. I've been in contact with many of the states with an active prescription monitoring program, predominantly Nevada, Hawaii, North Dakota, and Mississippi, and all have positive responses from the users, i.e. prescribers, dispensers, treatment professionals, boards and licensing, and law enforcement. Nevada has a primary focus of intervention and provides unsolicited patient reports to prescribers and dispensers to inform them that their patient is seeing multiple prescribers and multiple doctors at the same time. And this is often the first step in obtaining treatment for a substance abuse problem for the patient or ensuring that proper prescribing is occurring. And that's the end of my statement.
I think one of the questions we had out there from Representative Ledoux was if you had a board pharmacist sitting there just doing random checks, would that trigger any kind of a trail for future use?
Yes, it would. And that's one of the benefits of the database is it does track all the access points that have been into it, which is, you know, is a great, you know, tool for us in case you have other incidents that come up as somebody stalking or some of the other cases that can come up. We have another tool to track those type of things.
Representative Ledoux.
So in other words, the Board of Pharmacy would know which pharmacists are Googling the names, so to speak?
Yes.
It'd be which individual within the pharmacy, wouldn't it?
Right. They all would have an individual login password. And one of the things that would track also has to do with if somebody tried to share their password with others, you know, you can start looking at access time, how long they've been in there. You know, you can look at work records and say, why is your record being used and you're not even in the facility?
Well,
but why would you be looking at that?
Well, a lot of times it's an allegation that somebody's accessed my information. They shared it with a coworker. They shared it with their estranged spouse, that type of thing. And then you start looking for things to see who gave the data out.
So it would
follow.
So you'd only be looking at who was accessing the information if there was a complaint lodged that somebody's information had been disclosed.
Right.
Representative Newman, followed by Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Brian, I don't know if you're the one to ask this or not. Oh, by the way, my wife says thank you for their 400% increase on fees to licensed pharmacy techs you established a couple of years ago. But, you know, somebody, and following up on Representative Ledoux, so you have a pharmacist or a pharmacy tech who has access to that information in a pharmacy, filling a prescription, they pull up a person's name who's on that prescription. They don't get access to other information regarding that. I believe that's what Ginger testified to that, right? They don't have access to that. It only goes to a database. That information is applied to a database, and only the board has access to that information, only that's on that database.
I think what you're asking is, what it is, the pharmacist, if he's looking up the information, he's going to pull up your name or someone's name and say, what other prescriptions are you on? Just kind of to look and see if there's going to be any contraindications to the medicine that they give you. You know, if your prescriber doesn't know that you're on a heart medicine and he's giving you something that will have another prescriber gives you something else, and if there's going to be a problem with the two, the pharmacist has the ability to look that up and see and know if there's going to be a problem or not. And that's where the big health concerns come in. They want to make sure that when they dispense or they prescribe, that everybody has the accurate information and they're making the best health choice for the patient.
And if I may
follow.
And I understand that, you know, but I think if somebody is purchasing that, and I think this law would change it, but if they're purchasing it with cash, then that isn't currently on that pharmacist database. But if it's through an insurance program, that information is there now. But if they purchase it through cash from another pharmacy, it's not. And I know that this happens. My wife had to call out their doctors and say, you know, so-and-so just got a prescription last week from somebody else, that happens. But
Ginger, you want to take that one?
Yeah, through the
Please
chair.
Help, Ginger.
One simple clarification, that the database that's being proposed in this legislation is separate from the pharmacist's prescription database. This is only a database that provides limited information on those Schedule 1 through 5 controlled substances. So when somebody comes in and maybe they have a prescription for OxyContin, the pharmacist can go into their personally purchased database and look and see what prescription information is in there and give you a different reading. If they believe that maybe you have some drug diversion issues, they can log into this state database and see if you've been looking at multiple doctors, multiple pharmacies, see if there's a different pattern that's happening. Some pharmacists might choose to look at every single person who uses a Schedule 2, 3, or 4 drug. Some pharmacists may feel they know their client well enough that they don't want to look up every single prescription as it comes in. So that, I think there's two separate sources of information that a pharmacist can use to look at. The other question about a pharmacist going in on maybe a fishing expedition, one of those red flags that the Board of Pharmacy could determine if they would like to have an automatic report generated might be something where, let's just say Safeway Pharmacy typically administers 500 Schedule 1 through 5 prescriptions per day. And maybe the red flag on that is any pharmacist who views more than 2,000 records in one day. A flag will come up and say, you normally only dispense 500. Why did you look up 2,000 people? And that might be one of the security measures that you could, that the Board of Pharmacy could choose to put in there as a red flag.
Follows?
But if somebody is curious, they're probably not going to be reviewing 2,000 people. What they're probably going to be doing is reviewing the records of the lady next door or something like that. How is that going to end up showing up as a red flag?
Through the chair, the Board of Pharmacy is probably going to have the best understanding of what might look to be unusual searching or unusual record behavior. And they, in regulation, they can determine what kind of red flags they want to see come out of the database. They can kind of determine what looks favorable, unfavorable. It gives them the option to call doctors and say, does this patient have an unusual ailment that requires excessive medication? You know, it's up to the pharmacist and the doctor to really look at something unusual, and I think the Board of Pharmacy can put in those little alarms that are outside of the norm.
Actually, at this point in time, we have a pharmacist online that's only available for 10 more minutes, and I think we're going to pick him up, and then I'll go back to the rotation. Barry Christensen, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Yes, this is Barry Christensen. I'm a pharmacist. I'm also the co-chair for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. And I'm just online to answer questions, although I'll just tell you that we did a lot of commenting on the bill on the Senate side, and we're currently pleased with the changes that have been made with the committee substitute bill in front of you.
Well, at this point in time, I think I'll pick up with Representative Newman, and then Ledoux, and then Gardner. Pardon me?
Question for the pharmacist.
Yeah, I put you in the rotation on it. Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, Mr. Christensen, it's just my concern. I want to make sure that the Board of Pharmacists, they're the board who has access to this information and not anybody else. Can you or somebody put my mind at ease on that, that they're the only people who have access to this?
Representative, my understanding of the bill is it would be administered through the Board of Pharmacy, but as has been previously explained, they would be in charge of allowing access to the database to pharmacies such as mine, to physicians that are prescribing, or any prescriber, nurse practitioners. I can tell you this, the data we would be transmitting on controlled substances would be going directly to the Board of Pharmacy only through whatever portal they're using to gather the information electronically.
One question.
Sure.
Who would have access to Representative Ledoux's information?
Everyone. Representative, through the chair, my understanding of it is it's only going to be pharmacists and prescribers that are registered in some way or form with the Board of Pharmacy. And I would defer that question to the investigator or one of the state staff in terms of the specifics of how they're going to do that registration.
I assume that would be pharmacists, pharmacy techs, doctor's offices, the Board of Pharmacy. I mean, a lot of different groups would have access to any particular Alaskan's individual quite personal information.
Emily.
Representative Newman, through the chair, I'll go through on page 4 of the CS, starting with the first, and that's the personnel of the board regarding specific inquiries concerning licenses, and the authorized board personnel in line 2 for operational and review purposes. But a practitioner, and if we're still using Representative Ledoux as an example, who is treating Representative Ledoux specifically as his current patient, would have access to the database to inquire information specifically regarding Representative Ledoux. and that's where it becomes specific to their access. It has to be a current patient of theirs who they're in current treatment or who they're currently treating. And then on item four, a licensed or registered pharmacist who has the authority to dispense the controlled substance specifically for Representative Ledoux, who goes to pick up her prescription. She's a current patient of the requiring her prescription to be filled by that pharmacist, so that pharmacist can look into the database specifically for her and her prescription only, and no other person that he knows of that he's not currently prescribing or dispensing information or prescriptions for. And then number five, federal and state law enforcement agencies who have established probable cause and have received search warrants, subpoenas, or court orders. So they're listed as number six. And then you yourself would be able to access your own data and say, hey, I want to know what's being kept on me. And there would be a written request to the board, and they could provide that information to you. So those are the lists.
Mr. Christensen, it'd be helpful if you gave us a real brief summary on what Schedule 1 to 5 covers. Which drugs?
Sure. First of all, Schedule 1 would be considered either experimental drugs or drugs that basically are not being used pharmaceutically in a pharmacy. So we have no Schedule 1 drugs in our pharmacy. Down from there, you have Schedule 2, which would be, and by the way, drugs are classified by their potential for abuse. So number one would be, the first schedule would be those that are extremely addictive. Schedule 2 would be medications like oxycodone or Oxycontin or Percocet. Schedule 3 would be hydrocodone, which is commonly known as Vicodin. Schedule 4 would be the benzodiazepines, which is commonly diazepam or Valium. Number 5 is a short list of medications, mostly having to do with codeine-based cough syrups.
So the drugs that are covered by this bill are probably, what, 5% of the drugs that are out there, less than 5%, or? How many scheduled drugs, prescriptions do you write a year on a percentage basis? Is that 10, 15, 20%?
Of our volume, yeah, I would say that was probably a pretty good number. I'd say 15% probably.
Okay, so 85% of the prescriptions are probably not addressed by this bill.
That would be correct.
Any further questions for Mr. Christensen before we disconnect him? Representative Gardner?
Thank you. Mr. Christensen, you're a pharmacist, is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you have any sense or any information about how much pharmacists actually would use this database if it's in place as a voluntary tool?
I think Representative Gardner, would be used quite a bit. Currently, I'm going to give you an example. If we think that there is something peculiar about a prescription or about a patient, pharmacists get on the phone and start calling. They might call to check and see with the prescriber's office to see if everything's on the up and up in terms of if the patient had gotten a couple other prescriptions from a couple other prescribers to make sure the patient was telling the prescriber, yes, they had gotten medicine from other practitioners. So I know a lot of pharmacists have commented it would be nice to be able to just go to a database and to be able to see that, or at least, and this is not going to be live, obviously. It's going to be a little post, but we could at least get an idea so we have a little better feeling of when we think, and pharmacists are intuitive. We, you know, sometimes we know when we think there's something a little haywire with a particular individual or a prescriber for that matter. So my sense is that it would be utilized, and certainly not for everybody. I mean, if my neighbor, Mrs. Jones, comes in with a prescription for 12 pain pills from her dentist, I'm not going to go to the database because I know that that's not going to be warranted for her. But in other instances, yes, I do believe it'll be utilized, and I believe, I quite frankly believe the voluntary way is the way to go for this.
Thank you.
Let's see, Representative Ledoux, I think I cut you out of the rotation. Nope.
That's okay.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you just say voluntary? This is all voluntary? So it's voluntary by the pharmacist or voluntary by the...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Newman. I guess the voluntary part is the pharmacist going to the database to check every controlled substance prescription. What's not voluntary is that all pharmacists will have to report their controlled substances data to the Board of Pharmacy. That part is not voluntary.
Representative LeBeau.
And how much would you say that that will cost an individual pharmacist to report that? And is that all taken care of by this federal grant?
Representative LeBeau, we hope that our pharmacies will be like pharmacies in other states, and our pharmacy systems, our operating systems, our software systems will be able to interface with the portal that the Board of Pharmacy will be using for us to transmit the data. That's going to be the major hurdle. We're not the first state, we're not the last one. So there might be a couple of hurdles to jump there, but hopefully with the federal funds available, we'll be able to do that. In terms of what it costs once it goes online, it shouldn't cost a whole lot in terms of time from what we're being told. I hope that's true.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill? I know we've got Keith Mallard from the Troopers there for question only. If we have any questions for Captain Mallard, any questions?
I do have one.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have there any other means by which we've looked at cost recovery than those stated so far regarding convictions, regarding any other means aside from the federal and the state adjuncts to offsetting the costs of this should we lose the federal funding?
Who would you like to?
If he's the enforcement. You know, maybe he's the gentleman that needs to have this question.
Captain Mallard, are you with us?
I am with you.
You want to take that one?
I can give it a shot. I think...
Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record?
Yes, I'm Captain Keith Mallard with the Alaska State Troopers. I'm the commander of the Alaska Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement. Costs, you know, if you... The setup cost is the initial ticket shock. If you look around the country, the cost for after the initial setup is rather low, and I believe somebody else could probably testify to those exact numbers. Another question that was asked earlier was how well this has been utilized. In looking around the country, there's a number of different databases out there, and California, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, Utah, all of them are pretty well recognized as good programs, and on average per month they're getting about 5,000, roughly 5,000, most of them, inquiries a month, so the pharmacists are using the database. They break those numbers down as far as the reports, and it's mostly physicians and pharmacists that are doing most of the inquiries, so... that was just another question that was lying out there.
No question.
Nope. Representative LeBeau. Thank you very much. Ginger, you want to take a shot at the loose end?
Yeah, this is Ginger Blaisdell, staff to Senator Green. As far as cost of the program, what most states are finding is that the $400,000 that's available in the setup federal grant, typically, states are using close to that $400,000 amount, and that's usually setting up hardware, separate servers, setting up whatever software purchases might be needed within the Board of Pharmacy or wherever they house it. At the very low end, the state of New Mexico has ongoing costs of $13,000 a year. The state of Wyoming had an additional staff member hired, and also their license fees. Their ongoing cost is $90,000 a year. We're hoping that our costs will drop dramatically after the $400,000 mark.
Okay. follow up?
Well, not on that, but another point that I would like to put in the question in the for record here. In our packet, which I really appreciate all of the information, on page 3 of some information here provided through the Alliance of States with prescription monitoring programs, it might put to rest some of the other quote the bottom paragraph talking about of paramount importance. This is a protection of confidentiality. And it goes on to state that over the decades during which prescription monitoring programs have been operating, there have been no documented or anecdotal cases of breach of confidentiality of data. So that would seem to be to answer a lot of the questions that were fostered out there. And
Representative Gardner, nope.
No questions, thank you.
Oh, we have one gentleman in the room that would like to testify on their own. Yeah, William Strohr, am I close? Welcome, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bill Strohr, Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy for the Department of Health and Social Services. And online, I believe, is Dave Campana, the pharmacist for our Medicaid program. Dave will be able to answer the technical questions that I'm not able to. I'd like to start by saying that this was well described, and there's not a whole lot I can add to it other than that we are highly supportive of the program. We think it's a good bill. We think that the prescription drug monitoring program, with the success it's had in other states, does offer some benefit. I believe that it is good for us to continue to worry about the confidentiality, because that's always a risk, particularly when you're dealing with personal levels that of care that come under HIPAA regulations. My comments, this bill provides for a prescription drug monitoring program that brings a balance between safe use of drugs and the need to prevent illegal activity associated with drug diversion of controlled substances. It is a balanced program. It's about the, you know, the good use and the potential for identifying the bad use. The controlled drugs that have a potential to cause dependence include ones that were already mentioned, the Schedule 1 through 5. In terms of the Medicaid program that I oversee, out of a $68 million expenditure last year on drugs, about $8.6 million was Schedule 1 through 5 drugs. So the 15% number that was thrown out by, I think, Brian, is a good number. It works with Medicaid as well. Drug diversion to us is an activity where a person obtains a prescription for a controlled substance, such as OxyContin, which is the one that we see the most of, or other opioid-based pain medication for intended pain problem, and then illegally sells the content or some in some other way diverts the contents of that prescription to other use. The unintended use inappropriately adds to the cost of care to the Medicaid program by improper use of drugs and improper use of medical visits to obtain the drugs. And we all know that the cost of Medicaid keeps going up and up and up. Prescription drug monitoring program provides for enhanced pharmaceutical care, the safe use of medications beyond that currently available, including checking for contraindications from the variety of drugs. This program assists our Medicaid program and insurance program statewide by preventing drug diversion and inappropriate expenditures for diverted drugs. The drug program also reduces fragmented care, where a person obtains care from several health care providers and or facilities. Prescription program promotes coordination of care where health providers work together for the good of the patient. In our program integrity program, we look at much lower numbers of physicians shopping that is done than what the 20 to 30 that was mentioned earlier. The program also allows prescribers and pharmacies to ask questions of the database to determine who's been prescribing controlled drugs to their patients. That's not always reported, believe it or not. In another state that has a prescription drug monitoring program, a question of the database found one Medicaid recipient who received prescriptions for controlled drugs from over 40 doctors over 3 months. And in my past experience, we've had several recipients that have done that. When prescribers have information about their patient's drug use, they may better be able to alter their prescribing for the patient. The database will assist with detection of forged prescriptions. The prescriber sees his name associated with prescriptions that they did not write for someone who's not their patient. That's a great indication to them that they need to take a look about it, and they contact either the board or law enforcement on that. I'm going to skip the rest of this because it's already been stated and the day is late, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Any questions? And actually, I don't believe your pharmacist is online. If he has, you didn't register.
Okay.
But with that, is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? And again, is there anybody else online that hasn't had the opportunity? With that, I think we're going to close public testimony and bring it back to the committee. And again, we have two more committees past this one. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment to the bill. We've carefully, or the bill carefully delineates on page 3 the data that's going to be collected. And I see good justification for each part. You know, collecting the prescription number allows things to be tracked and see if that prescription's forged over and reused or something. But on line 20, number 9 is other relevant information as required by the board. And I'm sort of reluctant to allow an outside agency without legislative oversight to add other things to collect. I mean, what if they wanted to use a social security number or something that we might find objectionable? So I'd prefer to see them come back if there's other elements that they want to collect.
Great.
Given the fact that we're slammed on Friday, and this would probably hold the bill up for a week, would you have a problem working with the sponsor of the bill before it's scheduled to the next committee on clarifying the intent?
I guess I'd like to know the sponsor's
He's nodding his head, but I'll let the sponsor respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If your intent is just to delete number 9, just do it conceptually and we're good to go.
I'm very comfortable with that.
Is there any opposition to the bill is amended?
I'm just going to object for purposes of discussion, but I don't like the bill, but I can count the vote, so withdraw my objection.
Okay.
Wait for committee discussion.
We're in committee discussion.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
The amendment has, or the bill has, the amendment, and I don't believe there's any opposition to the amendment, is there? We'll have a roll call.
And that was to, if I may.
Delete 9 on
line 20, page 3, which is item number 9.
Okay. I have no objection to that.
But it's back to the committee, so.
Just for committee comment, again, I very respectfully, you know, I do not like this. I'm not going to stand in the way of this bill, and I will talk to the sponsor of the bill and try and work out my concerns and my assurances, and I feel confident in working with the sponsor that he's always worked very professionally with me in the past to address concerns that we've got and make sure that we deal with that. I'm confident that we will. And with that, if you'd like to move on to the bill, I'm glad to do that. Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill 316 /M from committee with any individual recommendations and as amended and attached fiscal notes.
Any objection? This bill will move on to judiciary. And again, I think we're going to wrap it up at 4:45. We're out of here.